Okay, great. Thank you, Shelley. Thank you. And, you know, very much enjoying my time here, and thanks very much indeed for the invitation to come. So what I'm hoping I will do is manage to get through really nucleoporins, laminas, and touching a little bit on trypanosomes, but the trypanosome thing really isn't relevant. So this is not a parasitology talk. This has got nothing to do with pathogenesis or really too much to do with these cells, which are trypanosomes. They're simply cells, and that's really all we need to worry about. Now, last week we had a little bit of a chat about what is evolutionary cell biology, and I was a little surprised that nobody came up with this sort of classic metaphor of the five or six blind men and the elephant. You know, this is a Larson version, which as ever is rather more entertaining, and I just put some names in, specifically putting myself here, you know, at the most important end. And really, the point I was trying to make is that, what it occurred to me is that, you know, we all know this metaphor, and I found this particular gem on the web. You know, this is what you can come up with, and it looks nothing like what any of us necessarily mean. And that maybe trying to define what we're actually, what we're on about. We all know what we mean, and to some extent, you know, we all have a view, and all of those views are valid. And actually, on the bus this morning, I was reading a book review of a paper about super predictors and various things by Peter Tetlock. And I just love this, is that, you know, the average expert is roughly as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee. And, you know, maybe, you know, we're trying to predict things in too much detail or trying to be too confident about our predictions is, you know, it's a cautionary note. We, you know, to some extent, we don't really know what we're doing. Okay, so I think Shelley showed this slide last week. And really, it's just to try to emphasize the problem as I see this. I'm a cell biologist. I'm interested in fundamental cellular processes, but in particular, my interest in parasites, which sit over here, I call them them, is that they are incredibly divergent from us, our hosts. And one of the things that, as a parasitologist, we hope to find is unique aspects to the biology, and that is then an exploitable. But the problem is this sort of asymmetry, which is a term that, in fact, Joel and I kind of came up with a little while ago, or several years ago, and that can really, you know, is that there's very little published, for example, on the parasite. So there's a number of publications, most of the publications, you know, are on opisthocoms. There's very little on excavates, which is the group that contains many, many parasitic taxa. So to some extent, we have an enormous problem of trying to map information over. And so the real challenge is trying to understand or trying to drive these things in the other direction. And you can try comparative genomics, and you can, that can be very, very useful. You simply look at the genomes and you ask what's present. But we've certainly found that for many of the very, very interesting systems, this isn't good enough, that we're missing things. We're either missing things because they are truly novel, that they are only present in these taxa. So by definition, if you use a query from a mammalian cell, you won't find it because it's got no homologue. Or alternatively, they are so incredibly divergent that your searches fail you. And I'll show you some examples, at least of the latter, later on. So this is, you know, this is a challenge. And one of the things that I'd like to understand is the eukaryogenesis event itself. How did we get from a simple prokaryote, with a comparatively simple cell architecture, although Damien has shown you that they can be really rather sophisticated, but how do we get from this up to these, you know, really baroque structures of extant eukaryotes, plants, parasites, mammalian cells, etc. And the order of events, how did these different things arise and at what step did they come in? So there is a big debate, and Joel and I and Damien have been discussing this about, you know, the order at which the mitochondria came in. So there is one school of thought, for example, that suggests the mitochondria came in quite early and powered many of these later events. There is another school of thought that I probably subscribe to, is that you required membrane trafficking for phagocytosis to bring in the endosymbiont that then gave rise to the mitochondria. Resolving those two is very difficult indeed, and I think I'm still agnostic, even though I have a sort of prejudice as to which model I favour, but this kind of thing is really fundamental to understanding these processes. Now, I have a very, very primitive view of evolution, and this is it. And I, you know, and it's to some extent I make no apologies because, you know, this can account for sort of 95% of evolutionary events, and it was recently shown by Bell Martin that there is, you know, he managed to show formally at least that there's a low amount of lateral gene transfer, for example, in eukaryotes. You know, so really, how do we get new functions? We just simply duplicate genes and we see neofunctionalization. And this may be, you know, simply by bottlenecking and fixing alleles, as Mike Lynch has shown, or it may be selection and various other processes. But, you know, this is fairly simple to understand. But we can take this a little bit further, and we can think about, you know, how do you build complexes? And again, this is something that Joel and I published 5 or 6 years ago now, was a sort of, or is 10 years ago maybe, was a kind of ratchet idea that certainly if you duplicate, you can end up with a new near-functionalized or slightly divergent paralog, and essentially in a sort of ratchet-like mechanism. This is not very different to the green, it's quite similar to the blue, and it will still fit in the blue complex, but that maybe relaxes constraints and allows more subunits to be evolved by paralogous duplication or even recruitment of novel factors, and eventually we can go from a blue to a green complex. And this, you know, provides a nice easy step way of doing things. And in terms of membrane trafficking or defining compartments, you know, there are complexes essentially that we know that define those structures, and so we can go from having just a blue one to a blue and a green. And that's a fairly simple model, I hope, to understand. So that's the idea of many of the sorts of models.
And in the ratchet idea is not just many small changes, but then it's unlikely to go backwards. Is that part, also part of the ratchet?
I think really, can you go backwards? I mean, you can lose things. Yes, absolutely. So you could lose a paralog. So you certainly could start to lose the ability to make a particular compartment. And there's many, many examples of that that's happened. I think the point is that the interface between this new subunit, if you've now got new sequence, that potentially relaxes constraints on its binding partners and therefore allows then potentially new paralogs to then start to co-evolve. So it's essentially relaxing the constraints on the structure. And I'll show, certainly, as I'll come on to in a moment, the nuclear pore complex actually provides us potentially with quite a good example of how this kind of changes could build up.
You mentioned ratcheting. Where does that come in?
Well, essentially, it's just, you know, we're moving along and we're building more diversity. So perhaps one good example is the TRAC complex, which is involved in anterior grade transport. And there are three versions. There's a core, and then there are two or three subunits that then diversify the functionality of that core complex, so that it has essentially, you know, we're partway along this route, so that we've now got several different routes as export. We've also got autophagy and various other processes involved. So it allows us to diversify. It's not a strict ratchet because you certainly can lose these things. And we know, for example, in trypanosomes that some of these complexes are not present. So it's so you can certainly go in the other direction. It's just a model really to try to explain how a multi-subunit complex could perhaps migrate into having something quite new. In particular, we devised this really to understand how RAB proteins, which are small GTPases, and SNARE proteins collaborate to define compartments. Even the concept of a complex here is a little loose. That there are multiple sets of proteins that are coming in together. So it's an assemblage, not necessarily a complex. I hope that's clear. Okay, so we've worked quite a lot on understanding membrane transport in trypanosomatids, but I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm going to talk about the nucleus, and it's really, you know, the nuclear envelope is critical to the eukaryogenesis event. And I sort of realized, you know, perhaps I'm extremely slow, but I sort of realized several years ago that, you know, one always thinks about the origin of the nucleus as being the defining event of eukaryogenesis, and there is a, you know, that's actually not true. It's the origin of the nuclear envelope, because that's what separates the genetic material from the cytoplasm. So it's the evolution of that structure that is critical. That's what defines the nucleus. If you don't have an envelope, you don't have a nucleus. And of course, the major feature about that is that you make a bag, but you have to poke holes in the bag, because otherwise you're dead. DNA is isolated from the rest of the cell, so you have to get things in and out. You have to get your RNAs out for translation. You have to get things like ribosomal RNAs back in to assemble your ribosomes and then re-export, etc. So you have to have this bi-directional transport system to allow things to get across. And if we look, for example, in yeast or mammalian cells, this system is incredibly complex. There's probably 20 or more routes that take various different classes of cargo. And so really, you know, how do we get to this point of this very, very sophisticated machine? How can we get from this to this? And is there some way that we can think about? So, an insight that certainly came that sort of unifies the nuclear pore complex and membrane trafficking came from my great friend and collaborator, Mike Rout, a sort of 3 o'clock in the morning moment, I suspect when he was heavily caffeined up and doing whatever he does at 3 o'clock in the morning, when he realized that when he looked at some of the subunits of the nuclear pore complex, that they look very, very reminiscent to membrane trafficking things. So this is part of the NUP84 complex that we'll come back to, and this is clathrin, the kind of classic endocytic protein. And they have beta propellers and a particular kind of coiled alpha solenoid. And both of these structures share that architecture. And I think Damien and perhaps Joel have probably mentioned this, that we grandly call the protocotomer hypothesis. And it's the idea that much of the architecture of the eukaryotic cell has this common structure. So I like to think of it as Lego, essentially, that you can put these bricks together in different ways, but essentially you're still just using a very, very limited number of architectural elements to achieve building a house, a spaceship, a motor car, whatever it is that you want.
How many of these guys involve hydrolysis, actually?
Hydrolysis?
Yes. So, for example, clathrin, in order to take it off,
You need an uncoated ATPase that's responsible for energy consumption. So certainly the step of assembling clathrin appears to be a thermodynamic assembly. And I think the same to some extent for cotamers as well. Yeah. The disassembly of these things certainly does require energy. For the nuclear pore complex, I don't know. It's quite stable, although there are subunits that seem to come on and off. And, you know, and whether there really is much of an energetic thing there in terms of an ATP hydrolysis, or whether it's thermodynamic interactions with other subunits that pulls things on and off, I don't know. I don't think we're not that far. Okay. But the interesting thing about this as well is that these all bend membrane. Okay. So we had a review out about 3 years ago where we talked about bending membranes, and so the common thread here is that all of these will assemble and will bend membrane. So this is basically what they do. They are just membrane bending elements. Okay. It's not the only way you can do it, and the ESCORTS, which is a system that was originally described by Scott Emmer as part of the late endocytic apparatus, we now know that this is involved in many, many processes, for example, cytokinesis. There's even some evidence now that it's involved in nuclear events as well as viral budding and various other processes. In fact, Jim Hurley had a little review out in EMBO about 6 months ago where he said ESCORTS everywhere, and the functions of these really seem to have exploded. So this is not the only way you can do it. It's just one way, but this is a particularly potent way of doing it. And perhaps the critical thing is that you can put these things together with different topologies, so you can build different structures based on the length or the angles that you subtend between these different subunits. Okay, so if you think about the nuclear pore complex, and I pinched this from a review, I apologize, I didn't put the citation on, but it's really just to demonstrate a couple of things. So these are nuclear pore complexes visualized in vitreous ice and averaged, and you can see that essentially it's a kind of sandwich. This is the membrane. There's sort of material both at the cytoplasmic and nuclear side, and there is a little bit of variability. So this is social amoeba. It's a little bit flatter, perhaps. Maybe these are a little bit less elaborate. Fibroblasts and then xenopozoocytes. But for the most part, if you look down on FAST, they are all very, very similar. They all have eightfold symmetry. The molecular weights of these things appears to differ slightly. You can do a calculation based on the reconstruction, how big you think these are. And some of that diversity may be keyed to the function. Again, I pinched this from a review and I apologize that I did this in a hurry, so I didn't put the citation on. It's Nature Reviews and Cell Biology. Very nice. Demonstrated where the MPC connects with chromatin. It connects with a whole bunch of other things. And there's some proteins referred to as TPRs that also seem to mediate that kind of connection. So it's not only is it a whole, but it's very, very actively involved in organizing and mediating nuclear function. And for example, it's important in defining regions of chromatin that are active and regions of chromatin that are inactive. And at least in mammalian cells and yeast, we know that being close to the NPC can activate, whereas ordinarily, when we're close to the nuclear envelope, this is where inactive genes reside. It's the classic way of switching things off.
How do we know that that's an, sort of an active task of the NPC rather than just proximity?
Because we know that you require this TPR protein, which is part of this structure called the nuclear basket, to mediate this. It interacts with the chromatin and defines essentially these elements. There are sequence elements as well that it is interacting with.
Okay, so
we
there know a it's series active. Of elements that are known to interact
yes,
with TPRs?
There are, yes, okay. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so this is a very simplified version of the model. And there's other things, and I won't go through all of these, but essentially we know, for example, this is mRNA exporting. These complexes we know associate with the nuclear pore complex and are responsible for quality control and control of splicing events and various other things to get things out. So this is a very, very active thing that went from simply being a whole to being something with many, many functions and essentially a hub of all nuclear organization. Now, if we go right back, this now is about a 25-year-old slide from Chris Akey. So this was a conundrum for many, many years. If you visualize the yeast nuclear pore complex, again, this is a vitreous ice reconstruction, you get this little itty-bitty little complex. But then when you look at rat, you have a much, much bigger structure. Okay, so this was nice. Plays to our prejudice that we're bigger than, plays to the idea that we're a little bit more complex. But the surprise came was that when the proteomes of yeast and rat nuclear pore complexes were published and were defined, it turns out that they're actually got built of exactly the same subunits. So the level of complexity here is not simply having more proteins or more flavors of proteins. There's something else going on that makes these really much bigger. And I'll come back to that shortly.
Okay. You said it went from being a whole to being a hub of activity.
Yes.
So how do you know it started out as a whole?
I don't. Sorry. I mean, conceptually, you know, that's what we understood, and that really was, you know, when the NPC started to be described, really very much people were focusing on understanding its transport functions, and then people started to realize that, in fact, you could see these interactions, you know, TPR with chromatin, and then the TREX complex, which is part of this mRNA processing. So it was very much conceptual that we began to realize that it had a much broader role.
I wanted to ask more naive, basic question. Is it conceivable that prokaryotes could have gotten to the pathway of multinucleated organism with differentiated cells by another mechanism besides putting a nuclear membrane around the nucleus?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. I think the answer to that is that we don't have an example. I will show a slide shortly, I think, that shows that in fact archaebacteria do have some elements that suggest that sort of potentially they're kind of vaguely on the path to this. But, you know, it's a very much simpler kind of system. I think it's become quite clear, at least for many of us, that during eukaryogenesis and the period between the first ancestor and the last ancestor, that we probably lost a lot of lineages. So it's quite possible there was an enormous amount of more diversity, indeed, of building things in a different way that could have happened, and we've lost them. We can't actually sample them. I think the feeling is still that Leica was a single event or population of organisms. It wasn't a massive conglomerate of highly divergent lineages. It was very restricted. So it was an extreme bottleneck.
I think
Leica is the last eukaryotic common ancestor, which is a hypothetical organism that when we distill our trees, we sort of use that as the root, as the term for the root. So it would almost definitely have had to have been membrane. I mean, there's probably no other way that we could have built that in terms of making sure that we blocked passive diffusion, for example. But it didn't necessarily have to be protocotomer. It could have been something else.
Okay.
So it sounds like your model, the model is that you don't just need the membrane. What you really need are the holes.
Absolutely. Well, you need both.
So do you have a model in mind for how you get both? How do you, because if you have membrane and no holes, you have a non-functioning nuclear envelope.
Absolutely. Yes.
But if you don't have a membrane, then the hole, there's no selection to have holes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm coming on to that, and that it absolutely is that we, you know, the model that I like, as to whether it's correct or not, is a gradual build-up of something more sophisticated and that more closer in it resembles a nuclear envelope, or something that was a lot less well organised. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's at least precedent for that. It's possible. Having examples is a little harder. But there's precedent.
So there are no examples of sort of alternate holes that
the only alternate structure that I know that goes into the nuclear pore is the spindle pole body, which is part of the mitotic apparatus. So you can put other things into the pore, but the nuclear pore complex really seems to be pretty universal. There are differences, as I'll show you, but I think that it's, yeah.
Just to clarify, so on that very first picture that you showed us, where you basically just showed the like the ER sort of having membrane surrounding the nucleus, but no pores.
Yeah.
So it could have gone through a step like that.
Absolutely.
Where
yes.
There was sort of a, not exactly a continuous membrane.
Yes.
But this is where the membrane came close to.
Absolutely. I'm looking here because I know I've got a slide that speaks exactly to that. So maybe if I just move on.
And we'll,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because I think it's exactly what I'm trying to drive at. So okay. So these are my friends, my beasts, which are trypanosomes. This is the African trypanosome. This is the American trypanosome. Trypanosome cruzi, causes invasion of Chagas disease and Leishmania. Despite their cuddly appearance, they really are quite nasty, and that's one of the reasons why we work with them. Trypanosome brucei, the African trypanosome, is a hemoflagellate. It lives in the bloodstream. If you're not treated, it will kill you. There's almost no known cases of spontaneous remission. So again, another reason why we use this. But the real reason that we use this is that it's right over the other side of that evolutionary tree. It's about as far away from us as it is possible to get. So there's about a 1.5 billion years difference between these creatures and us. So, and they are tractable. We can do things with them.
So I have the recollection that they're inside of, for example, the termite gut as part of the way they do business. Is that right?
So whether in termites, I'm not sure, but they are present in many, many insects.
So yeah, and the reason I was asking, because I was just curious, are there any animals for which they're symbiotic and they can hang out without them being pathogenic?
It's interesting. There are. I mean, this guy, this is Trypanosoma brucei, if I'm infected, if it's Rhodesiense, which is the East African form, I will be dead in a month. But if I infect a lion, no problem, or a giraffe, or many other animals. So there is what we call the phenomenon of trypanotolerance. It's probably that it's pathogenic to us because it's only gone in recently and we've not quite got the mechanisms to control the infection properly. So, yeah, absolutely.
How large are they?
I'm sorry?
How large?
They're about 10 to 20 microns in length. They vary quite a bit. They are quite sort of heterodispersed in their morphology. There are many that are just insect parasites. There's a clade called Leptomonas that is in firebugs, which I think you have here. They're all over the world, and they carry exactly the same species of Leptomonas. There seems to be quite little variation. It's just a global presence. Doesn't seem to do the firebug too much damage. So those really become commensurals. As to whether it's a symbiosis, I don't think we're aware of that yet, as to whether it's actually doing something beneficial. Okay. So we can forget parasites, really, because the rest of this now is just dealing with cells. So this is at least one view of the nuclear pore and its interactions. So here is the pore, and it has this central channel. And then this is the TREX complex. This is the thing that mediates mRNA export. It interacts with the lamina, which is the nuclear skeleton that holds things together. This is a spindle pole body, just to demonstrate that we can have an alternate assemblage in there. And essentially things go in and out, and they are mediated by interactions with various cargo receptors, most of which are called carrier ferrins, but there are others, MEK67, CRM1, etc. There's a whole group of these, and we won't go into that this morning. Now, about...
Sorry, just one quick thing, curious. So that you had mentioned insertion of the nuclear envelope of the spindle hole body. You've got something driven there, the tethered and microtubule organized, but there's no proteins in there. Is anything known about how...
Yes, the composition of this is known. Not to me, I have to admit, because I can't remember, but it is known. It's been
pretty
well characterized.
Well, the microtubule organizing center is known, but what about the proteins that are connecting it and inserting it?
To the spindle.
No, to the membrane.
So the membrane, the spindle pole body.
There's
I honestly don't know. I'd have to plead complete ignorance on that.
The cytokine proteins are also involved.
Sorry?
The cytokine proteins?
Right, are involved in the spindle pole body. Okay. Yes, okay.
And there's a protein, at least in Pombia, I assume in other organisms, that is important for inserting pores. It has something to do with getting new pores into the membrane, and it also affects the spindle pole body. Cut 11.
Yeah, but cut 11 is a nucleoporin.
Sorry, we don't really need to go into too much detail.
I'm trying to remember which one, but it is part of it. It is a nucleopore complex.
I was really just wondering, is it the same proteins involved?
In terms of anchoring, no, it's not. No, I mean, the Suncash proteins are not required for nucleopore complex assembly as far as we know. None of the genetics or biochemistry suggests that they've got a direct involvement. We'll come back to that, because the actual anchoring of the nucleopore complex is known in mammals and yeast, and we think it's different in trypanosomes. It seems to be using an alternative mechanism. Okay, so if you remember, I said that many of these proteins are modular. They have this beta-alpha kind of structure. And it's also become clear that as we've looked at more higher resolution models of the nucleopore complex, and again, this is work from my collaborator, Mike Rout, and he published this structure, and essentially you can see this kind of modular assembly of what we call outer rings and inner rings, and these are the sort of structural elements, and then shoved through that are a group of proteins that we call FG nucleoporins. And this starts to provide a way of understanding maybe how this thing has been built, because the scaffolds are all of these protocotoma type things, the betas, beta alphas, and just alphas, and then the FGs are disordered. So I tend to think very much that this is a pore into which you've shoved a bunch of noodles. And it's the FGs that are responsible for the selective gating. So they are essential to maintain the distribution of proteins across the nuclear envelope, but they are not required to maintain the pore itself. So there's a clear functional differentiation. Yeah?
Do all of them have eight-fold symmetry?
As far as we know, yes. We actually think it might be 16-fold, but they're certainly, it's essentially it's 8-fold, yes. They're all 8-fold.
Any explanation for why that should be?
Yes. Which I'm going to come on to later on. But we think that it may well simply be a paralogous expansion and that we've had duplications. We actually think there's a very ancient duplication that doubled the subunits in the MPC. And so that's why I say we think it's probably more 16, that each monomer is actually is two subunits or two units. You do see 7 and 9 sometimes. But quite low abundance. One of the problems with a lot of this is that all of these structures are based on averages of 1,000 NPCs. And of course the algorithm has thrown out the 7s and 9s because it said I can't fit that. There's too much noise, so out it goes. So the actual diversity of the nucleopore structure really remains something that we don't fully understand. There is clearly some evidence that there is differentiation between different tissues and different cell types, but we have very, very little handle on that at the moment.
Are there mutants that have different size pores? Or
not that have been isolated, to my knowledge. I mean, you can certainly, with some of the FG nucleoporins, I think Susan Venti's knocked a huge number of these out, and they start to look a bit raggedy, but they still, as far as I recall, are still predominantly eightfold. As to whether she's sat and looked at hundreds to see what the distribution is, I don't know whether she's ever done that. I don't think it's been published. Okay, so this is the sort of manifest. And it starts to, at least conceptually, we can think of this as the sort of structure, and then this is the functional differentiation bit. And then this thing I may come on to if I get time, but I'm suspecting I probably won't. Okay, so I'm going to skip over this, which is just a bit of informatics. From Tony Paul. So we went into the trypanosome and isolated nuclear envelopes and looked to see what we could find. And the reason that we had...
I don't understand what the spiky graphs are on histograms.
Where are we? These. Well, I'm sorry. Okay, excuse me. So blue is beta structure propensity, and pink, magenta, is alpha structure.
What's the x-axis?
It's just across the, it's just the residue number.
Okay.
Okay, so N and C terminus, I'm sorry. Okay. So the problem that we had was that if we just did BLAST into the trypanosome genome, we got SEC13, which is up here, which is this itty-bitty little one, which is highly conserved and, for reasons that I won't go into, is quite easy to identify. And I think we got one other, and we got nothing else. So, you know, we thought, well, maybe the trypanosome has a completely different nuclear pore complex. The problem is, if you look by EM, it's indistinguishable from a yeast or mammalian NPC. So that really, we felt, was a pretty much a non-starter. So what we did was isolated nuclear envelopes and did a huge amount of proteomics and identified all of the proteins associated with the nuclear envelope. And we came up with a list, and we validated that list based on tagging and demonstrating that indeed the proteins had gone to the nuclear envelope. So these weren't guesses, they were high quality guesses with some additional evidence. And we see beta, beta alpha, alpha, FGs, and again there's a couple of guys down here that I might come back to, and we've since extended this, he says, more recently. So this is the validation that we can tag these genes, demonstrate that the protein indeed goes to the nuclear envelope, and we can do extensive pull out, for example, and we can pull down the whole thing, and we can demonstrate that the entire thing really is part of a complex. Okay, so we can sort of bootstrap our way around this to be absolutely certain that these really are parts of this structure. Okay. There is an endless debate in the field as when is a nuclear pore and a nuclear porin that Shelley is probably aware of, because there are proteins that kind of shuttle on and off. So the precise definition is a little arbitrary. Okay. So again, we found, in fact, what we found was a few more. So we pulled this entire thing down and we found even more subunits. So I think we're now up to 25. So that's quite good. So when we started looking at this in a little bit more detail, we found a couple of surprises. And one of the surprises was this thing. This is the so-called NUP84 complex, and this is a major structural element. This is one of the sort of core scaffold. It's referred to as the Y-shaped complex for obvious reasons. This is just rotary shadowing EM. And I won't show it, but people now have done a lot of crystal structural work and have managed to really put this thing together very, very nicely, and we know where these subunits are. Okay, so we've got a very good structure for this complex. People like Ed Hirst and various others have contributed towards that.
Sorry to bug you about this again, but I'm just very curious about it. So, and is ATPI or some hydrolysis needed to disassemble, do you know?
There's no evidence. Okay. Absolutely no evidence about ATP involvement for assembly or disassembly, to my knowledge. Yeah. I don't think it's been looked at. I mean, the attempts to look at this have been, you know, things to simply sort of knockouts or, you know, in yeast, for example, and that certainly the biochemistry there hasn't really been looked at. I mean, it's a very good question, but there's nothing at the moment. We still don't really know how this thing is assembled. There's some evidence now.
How okay. These different subunits are held together, let's see, show C, and what type of interactions are there?
These are mainly ionic and standard interactions. So those are just binding, standard protein-protein interactions. So it's ionic or it's hydrophobic interactions. So there's nothing special about these at all. Yeah. This is not cross-linked or covalent or anything. Yeah. They can, in the right conditions, you can pull these down as a complex. If you use slightly different conditions, they'll dissociate. Okay, so this was one of the first sort of stories that we found, was that when we looked at the equivalent complex in trypanosomes and we could pull it out, we found an extra subunit or two. And we think that, in fact, the trypanosome has potentially a larger NUP84 complex, which was a little bit of a surprise to us, because this NUP84 complex is almost identical in humans and yeast. Well, no, it's rats and yeast. Okay. So something's going on. There's a sort of bit of structural riffing, but it's not that exciting, but it certainly to us was at least a hint that we were getting somewhere. So we tagged everything and pulled everything down. Or rather, Sam Abardo did this. And this is an enormous amount of work. This has taken him about 3 to 4 years of different conditions. But essentially what each of these represents is that we've got an epitope tag on one of the complex, or one of the proteins, and through using lots and lots of different conditions, he's arrived at conditions of where he can get a subcomplex that is consistent. Okay. So this is our panel, and what this allows us to do is to start to put things together. It's essentially like a nearest neighbor analysis, is that we can now begin to start to ask who's next to who, and in evolutionary terms, which ones are similar to who's next to who in yeast, for example. We went a little further than that because we kind of realized something was a bit up with this. As we still looked at this in detail, we realized that there were some connections here that just didn't quite match if this was identical to yeast. And this was game work from Sam. And what he did here was that this is immuno-EM. So the gold particles, the black dots of gold particles that essentially are bound to one of the proteins using an antibody. And this, in fact, is what we call a montage. So this is about 20 or 30 sections that have been layered on top of each other, because we only get one or two gold particles in each individual nuclear pore, and have been carefully aligned. I don't know if you can see that the membrane, in fact, is here. There's a little bit of an electron density, and you can see the center is here. So we can align these things and stick them on top of each other. And we can ask the simple question, where are they? Are they on one side, are they on another side, or are they in the middle? And so this protein, we knew from other evidence, sits at the nuclear phase. So very nicely, this is our control, and this character is clearly is down here. Okay. All of the others end up being symmetrical. Okay. So they're at slightly different positions with reference to the mid-plane, but they are symmetrical, they're on both sides. Now this was a surprise, because if you do the same experiment with yeast, you get quite a lot of asymmetric positioning of these subunits. So some of these, I think, where is it, 64 for example, is highly asymmetric in yeast. I forget whether it's nuclear or cytoplasmic, but in TRIPS it's not. So we've got something really, even though the proteins are the same, we've got really quite a different arrangement. And so we can take this information plus our pullouts, and we can build structure for the outer ring, inner ring, connections to the nuclear basket, as it's called here, and we can really demonstrate that in fact these complexes are actually for the most part what we would expect, but we're seeing this symmetry rather than this asymmetry. And that was quite a surprise. And the asymmetry has certainly been suggested as being important for differentiating things coming in and things going out, but they are seeing different parts of the noodles in the centre of the pore for export and import, and that flavour, if you like, is part of the specificity of differentiating the two faces. One other thing is that, yes?
Yeah, you don't have to go if it's too far off the track, but so these proteins are asexual, any of them? So you knock out one of these components and
none of the FGs are essential, as far as I recall. I mean, remember the experiment that Susan did where she clawed out half of the FG repeats and the cells were still alive. They weren't happy, but they were still alive. I think things essentiality in this context is not necessarily that helpful. Yeah. We know that if we knock down some of the scaffold, sort of inner ring and outer ring, then we do see significant hits to fitness. But we're not necessary. But the FG is much, much lesser.
So let's see. Did I understand that there are two unique components of the trypanosome nuclear complex? Did you mention?
There are. Yes, absolutely. We believe in the scaffold. We've got an extra couple of components. Yes.
So are those potential therapeutic targets?
Probably not.
You're not.
No. Probably not. But they may be if we could disrupt that interaction, but I think that's probably a tough ask actually for various biochemical reasons.
But
sorry, just make sure I understand how to interpret this. So for NUP 132, you've got a blue dot, which means it's an exact...
Sorry, the blue dot means itself.
But then the other ones, these are...
So the gray, I'm sorry, I should really have gone a little... Okay. So essentially what we've got down here is the tagged protein, and what we believe its ortholog is, and then across here we've got the things that we've identified.
Oh, that's what came with it, not that there's a relationship.
Yes, no, absolutely. So this is what we've isolated with it. So, for example, NUP 132, we obviously find 132 itself, and then this other bunch of things, and they're in this sort of beige colour, which is we've assigned these as being potential scaffold proteins. Okay. So essentially, what this has allowed us to do is that, you know, overall, you know, we are seeing things that look quite similar, but the arrangement is subtly different. That it's, and at one level, I guess it's a lesson, because we had to look very, very deeply to really understand this. Just simply looking at the list of proteins really didn't give us this level of insight, that we had to look very, very hard indeed.
So some of these differences, I mean, a little bit different. I mean, it still looks, if I've understood correctly, substantially different. I'm just asking about timescales. So you're saying there were virtually no differences in this level of order of magnitude between yeast and human.
There's not an enormous difference. There are compositional differences between yeast and human. We are seeing bigger compositional differences with trypanosomes. But overall, the vast majority of subunits are retained.
I see.
Okay, we are seeing some changes. So, say that NUP84 complex, we're seeing an extra potential couple of subunits in there. And we know now from these pullouts that they are part of that outer ring.
But the changes is more what associates with what?
No. What we find that associates is that the complexes really still seem to be pretty much the same, except that we are seeing sometimes subunits either completely missing. So they're not in the genome, they're not in this manifest, or novel subunits that we don't find in yeast and humans that are part of that complex. Okay. So the overall core is very, very similar. Okay. Yeah.
And then the only reason I ask, I think about essentiality is that, right, you have to do something pretty drastic to, like, kill a cell, or you have to get rid of, like, all transport or significant transport to actually have an effect on viability or something like that. And so, I'm just saying there's tweaking we can do even in yeast, where you can get rid of things or whatever, and the pores are essentially.
Yeah, but I think the point is that, you know, they're in YPD, they're not actually particularly stressed, and you're not doing a competition between that and a wild type. So we do see, you know, quite strong, you know, fitness hits essentially, because they're not growing as fast, but they're not dying on us. Yeah. So they're not happy. So some of these knockouts, you know, we've not done these, but other people have done them in a whole genome-wide screen, and you know they clearly are, you know, needed to be more. To be wild type. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I think coming back to your question, this is really just a summary again of this NUP84 complex, is that we see differences between yeast and the human complex, and we see some similarities and some differences. And so there's some sort of riffing going on that we don't fully understand why that's happening, but there's flexibility in there. There's fiddling around in some manner. Okay. Now, one of the things that is also is quite interesting is that we know, for example, in yeast and mammalian cells, there are transmembrane domain nucleoporins that are called things like GP210 and POMs that are responsible for anchoring the MPC into the envelope. And that, you know, makes sense that, and, you know, nice models of the idea that you maybe insert these things quite early on, and that provides a structural platform for the assembly of the rest of the complex. We can't find anything that's got, or we couldn't find anything that had a transmembrane domain. But what we did find was this thing, NUP65, in Saccharomyces, NUP65 has a so-called ALPS motif that is an amphipathic helix. So it kind of sticks to membranes but doesn't go through. In humans and Arabidopsis, there's no obvious hydrophobic thing at the C-terminus, but the trypanosome one has a genuine transmembrane domain. Okay. And we're pretty confident, based on, you know, blast and architecture, that this probably is the ortholog, although you can see the predictions here, you know, that thing's a little difficult, and this is obviously why we couldn't identify things, you know, directly from the computer. But it suggests to us that you can fiddle with the way that you anchor, and that maybe what this is telling us, it doesn't matter how you do it, but you just have to get the job done. And that you can just select for that sort of stable anchoring mechanism, and that you can have this ALPS transmembrane domain transition.
How did you identify these alterations?
Sorry?
How did you
identify? This is just purely prediction in the. Yes, just purely computer based predictions.
In which method?
I have no idea. I can't remember. There are several packages, and we usually use two or three.
They quite often give very different results.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, we do use several to make sure that what we're predicting here we think is reasonably accurate. But, you know, it's a prediction. Absolutely.
So Mark, once you have the protein, then you can use comparative genomics.
That's right, yes.
That's a simple forge. We're
in the throes of doing that, so we haven't completed it. Yes, absolutely. It's one of those backburner projects that really is still backburner, but it's something that urgently we should be doing now we've got this. I think we've got a fairly complete list. Okay, so there's one other point. So this is our map. I hate this diagram, but anyway, I think we're kind of stuck with it because it's got a lot of information. So this is our map, and this is where the various bits are. And I hope that you can see that for the most part, you know, the bits are in the same place. That's really the take home from that, is that this is yeast, and this is trypanosomes, okay? So there's not massive differences. But there is a big difference in that we're seeing this thing is missing, okay? And this thing is critical. So this thing is the RNA export machinery. Okay. So this contains a very, very large nucleoporin. Is it SEC358, Shelley? I'm looking at you. I can never remember these numbers, but it's a whopping great protein that acts as an anchor for a protein called DBP5, another one called GLI1. And these two are responsible for mRNA processing and unloading into the cytoplasm. Okay. So trypanosomes just don't have it. We already suspected they didn't have it because we couldn't find them in the genome. But with this extensive interactome analysis, we're now pretty confident that it's not just that we can't find it using the computer, but we can't find it even in any of our pullouts. And a reminder that we've done large numbers, and we've even pulled the whole thing down under low stringency, and we're still not finding candidates for things that could be these proteins. Okay. We're very confident about DBP5, for example. We're absolutely sure about that. So what this leads us to then is that we've got this, you know, rather simply, we've got this conserved scaffold. I've already said there's a bit of riffing going on with the subunits, fiddling with the way that you anchor, but we still anchor. We have a nuclear basket, but then at the cytoplasmic phase, it's completely different. Okay. And this makes, certainly at least in terms of thinking about functionality, it makes to me quite a lot of sense. So summary of that is that we can think about, you know, where is the diversity? The diversity is here. Simply subunits are missing from the trypanosomes. There's diversity in membrane anchoring, for what reasons that I think are unclear to us at the moment. And then there is diversity, in fact, in the nuclear basket. I probably don't have time to go through that, but we believe trypanosomes make their nuclear basket using distinct proteins that do almost the same job. Is in yeast, but they're using a distinct set of proteins. Okay. So this is where the action is. Okay. This is where the nuclear pore complex meets the proteome in the nucleus, and it's where it meets the proteome of the cytoplasm. So this is where, if you are going to change and you need to be flexible because you've got to meet 10,000 different proteins and deal with those, this is what you have to worry about. You don't need to worry about the scaffold. We also think that some of the reasons simply for why the scaffold is so well conserved in terms of size of proteins, so we noticed, you know, they're all about the same size, we don't see big ones and small ones, we see them all very similar, is just simply spatial constraints. We need to bend this membrane, and we need to bend it with a certain degree. They're always about the same distance, so we can't mess with this architecture too much. So this is very heavily constrained purely architecturally. This has to be more relaxed, simply to talk to transport factors and cargo.
And if you had added mammalian cells to that diagram you just showed us, is there that it would also be consistent, like the fibrils are very different between?
Yeah, mammalian cells are very similar in this to yeast. Okay. It's very similar. Okay. Yes, yes. There's homologs of GLUT1 and GPP5, but so it's the human thing is the NUP358. It's the cytoplasmic fiber anchor. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
If you go back to the present in the yeast and the rat ones, that's not explained on these.
No, it's not. I'm coming on to that. Okay. So this is, you know, this is so this makes sense in terms of trying to explain why we've got this diversity and why the diversity may or may not be there. And, you know, it may be a just-so story, but at least it provides us with something to put in the discussion for our publication. It makes some sense. Okay. Now, we've also, you know, this is actually something that Damien and I put together some time ago. But, you know, there's stuff going on that is in Archie that starts to look a little bit like trying to build internal membranes and starting to organize chromatin. And this goes back to the question that somebody asked earlier. So, you know, we have sort of, you know, chromatin-like proteins or sort of, you know, histone, archaeal histones. They're very different, but they, you know, they organize. We have some membrane benders. We have escorts. We have dynamine, which was another part of this system. So it starts to make some sort of sense that we could, you know, this is not actually quite as primitive, you know, as we might believe. And, you know, maybe what we're looking at is building up complexity in a stepwise manner. So coming right back to this is that, you know, yeast is small, rat is big. And this paper that was published from Martin Beck, I think it was in Cell, and actually got another one that has come out in Science, which I'm not sure what's different, but he's got another paper. This is, again, a beautiful reconstruction. Now, the mammalian nuclear pore complex, and perhaps resolve some of the reason why this thing is so much bigger. So the resolution he's now getting is sufficient to be able to see these Y-shaped NUP84 complexes. Okay, so we're now almost down to being able to map and dock things at atomic level because we can now start to dock crystal structures. But what's most relevant here is that he realized that, in fact, there's not one ring of NUP84, but there's two. Whereas in yeast, we absolutely know definitively there's only a single ring. Okay, so we've got a double ring. Why? I don't know. And it's not clear why, but clearly this is now, we've made a slightly bigger one, no increased compositional complexity, because these are all the same proteins in the green and the blue. It's exactly the same complex, essentially, to build these two things. So we're able to get bigger. Okay, so I think Shelley was asked about this. So how do we go from this little guy, you know, to something with a full-blown nuclear pore complex? And Mike and I published this a couple of years ago, and was, you know, it's not, I find it obvious, but maybe it isn't completely obvious, that if we had a primitive membrane-bending protocotoma, and we have potentially, you know, such things in primitive or sophisticated prokaryotes, and discussing this with Joel, and you know, there may be such a thing. We can think about, you know, just it caps membrane. So we have invaginations and we need to stabilize that kind of structure with something, otherwise it's just going to pop back. Okay, so we need to have something thermodynamically to control that. And then you can imagine that perhaps you get a little bit more complicated and that maybe you have a paragus duplication, you've got two different flavors and you start fiddling with your subunits and you've got many other things. And then perhaps we can get to a point of where we come into sort of more close proximity, at which point we start to look like a pore. Okay. So this would be what I would sort of refer to as some sort of fenestrated ER network, which is starting to wrap around the chromatin. And we know the ER is fenestrated, so that's not a big reach in terms of the way that these things are structured. And we know that there's sort of associations with the ER that position. So we start to get a pore, and then once we've got a pore, we've stabilized this, and then we need to gate it. And these green things are then bringing in FG repeats to start to gate that structure. And then we get to this thing in Fika, the first eukaryotic ancestor, that has a proper gated nuclear pore complex. Okay. None of this really required me to show you all the data that I've shown you. You could sort of almost have worked this out from pre-existing information. But I put this thing together, and it didn't work very well. But this is me ordering things, and a slightly different version that I hope does work a little bit well, is that this is what I've shown you already. exactly is the idea of the membrane kappa, and then it has fenestrations. And then really, to answer somebody else's question, we get sort of subunit duplication. So this maybe is where we can start to think about having eightfold or fourfold symmetry, and we start to get something a little bit more complex. And then we put a gate, and then we put more gating on, and at this point, you know, we're almost at the last eukaryotic common ancestor. And we think that we have this additional function of the nuclear basket that seems to be present in all the nuclear pore complexes that we can see. TRIPS have it, although they may be doing something slightly different, but they have it, as well as plants, yeast, mammals, etc. And so this would be sort of our Leica configuration, potentially. But then we start, and it's symmetrical. That's the critical point. So this is the trypanosome NPC. It has symmetry. Trypanosomes have a very, very simple way of processing their RNA. So they do, they transplice, they put a specific reaction. There's no cis splicing, there's no fiddling around with alternate splicer forms. It's just they take the RNA, they take the open reading frame, and they splice it, and they put a poly A tail on it, and out it goes. That's it. Okay. So maybe we don't need any kind of quality control of a sophisticated manner that we see in mammalian cells or yeast. We don't have to have that. We only need one way out, and so we don't need all of this hoopla at the cytoplasmic phase. Then we start to build in some asymmetry, and we think that this could be sort of relaxation of those constraints, and there's some details I haven't gone into, and then we have potentially more asymmetry, and we build up these cytoplasmic fibrils that then allows this sort of very sophisticated RNA processing to take place. And then, as we saw from the recent data from Martin Beck, that we can then build even more elaboration by doubling up on some of these subunits, some of these individual elements, and we can build something even bigger. Of course, the obvious flaw of that is that I'm arranging my Russian dolls in an order that I like, and that, of course, doesn't mean that that's actually the order of events. It could be the trypanosome is some secondary reduction. We can't rule that out. But I think at least we've kind of got examples of all of these states. They can exist. It doesn't mean that this is the order, which is why I refrained from putting an arrow on it, is that we can't actually do it. Okay? Yes?
I think the gating apparatus might have been used as something else and then just sort of got stuck on a nuclear port.
It's a very interesting question, and certainly, you know, I wondered exactly that. You don't find FGs anywhere else in the genome. We did quite a lot of mucking about, with the exception of plants. There's also FG-rich proteins in cell walls, in plant cell, higher plant cell walls. And, you know, a sort of slightly grim story is that we tried to set up a way of predicting FGs using some heavily computational intensive method. And this was with Brian Chait and David Fenyo at the Rockefeller. And then we realized we didn't need to do that. You just blast through for FGs, and actually you find that that's it. You know, if we look in trypanosomes, that's all we get back. If we look in any other system, so with the exception of higher plants. So it doesn't look like it. It does look, that rather to me suggests that they are only ever associated with this. We know quite a bit more about how this kind of gating works, and various people refer to it as virtual gatings and gels and various other things. And it is very clear from that data that this FG kind of structure is absolutely critical to getting that gating to work. It's probably too complicated to go into right now, but there's a way in which hydrophobic interactions essentially occlude this and can be pushed apart as you bring cargo through. And it provides a selectivity mechanism.
I'd be curious about what's known about the evolution of the inner nuclear membrane components, the one that laminate and
I can very quickly, that was the second part of the talk, and I can, if you can indulge me for another 20 minutes, okay. I can rip through that fairly quickly, and I'll skip over a couple of other things.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure.
Yep. Okay, yes. Good. Yes?
So you're talking about similar proteins elsewhere in the cell. I remember that, like in cilia, I think there's also nuclear pores are somehow involved, or
yes,
nuclear pores,
yes,
are somehow involved.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
There.
Yes. So that's one of the only real stories of differentiation of the nuclear pore complex that's connected to function. So in the micronucleus, which is transcriptionally inactive, there is a different flavour of NUT98, I think, which is one of the FGs, and the F is replaced by another amino acid. I'm afraid I've forgotten what it is, but the repeat is corrupted, if you like. There's four, and the two with the corrupted FGs go to the micronucleus and appear to block that process, whereas the two with the regular FGs go to the transcriptionally active macronucleus. I'm still waiting. The tetrahymenate nuclear pore complex has been done, but it's not been published. And I'm bouncing up there hoping to see that data, because I think from that it does tell you how you could fiddle with this structure and you could switch it on and off. It is also certainly possible.
So in ciliar flagella, is it known now if they actually form some kind of pore there?
The evidence is still contested, but I think it's beginning to firm up. Yes, that certainly a number of these are definitely present at the base of the cilia.
They form the same structure.
We don't have structural information on that yet. No, absolutely. I mean, that's been pretty tough. I mean, in fact, you know, we're hoping trypanosomes, because they're flagellated, you know, might actually be a way to get at that, because it's actually quite easy to take the flagelli off, and that we know that 109, for example, is one of the trypanosomes, is at the base of the flagella. So there does seem to be something going on there, and if it is this kind of membrane bending gait, then that would be really quite exciting.
Because you might have pulled that out then.
It's present, probably. Remember, there's 250 NPCs in the nucleus, and one of these structures at the flagella. And so at some point we have to draw a line in our proteomics and our MPI scores and say, no, that's junk. Yeah. So it may be in there, but we've not been able to.
But
the pull downs are from whole cells.
Ah, okay.
Yes, we have the wonderful technique that I'm prepared to bore anybody with that allows us to do that. But probably now's not the... It is very techie, so now's not the right place to do that. Okay, so somebody asked about lamins, and I'd be very, very happy to very, very briefly talk about that. And I'll probably skip over the data that we have on the trypanosome lamina, and maybe just pick up here. And this is probably where we were 3 years ago in terms of understanding the lamina story, or the lamins. So we've known for decades that these 60 kilodalton proteins, associated with the nuclear envelope, they come in several different flavors, A, B, and C, and that there's differential expression in metazoa as to where these are, and there's some slight differences in terms of their localizations. If I remember correctly, lamin A tends to be more peripheral and B can be a little bit further in. So there is a little bit of functional differentiation between them, and they form coils. With a little bit of information as to how that's assembled, although again that's not particularly high resolution at the moment. They're prenylated, and that's essential for binding to the nuclear envelope, and they're associated with many diseases, so that's one of the reasons why we know so much about them. And they were thought for decades that this was just metazoa, because you can't find them in fungi. Okay, so this was the sort of dogma. And it went unchallenged for many, many years. And, you know, we're all very happy that that was the way that a mammalian cell, you know, built its nucleus, and that everybody else did it differently. And that turns out to be not the case. Okay. So about 3 or 4 years ago, Ralf Graf's group in Germany identified a lamin in slime molds. And there's absolutely no question that that's a lamin. Okay. He was quite careful with his wording when he published this work, but there's absolutely no question that it has exactly the right structure. It's got even got the prenylation motif and CDK1 phosphorylation site. It's a lamin. Okay. But the problem with that is still, this is one arm of the eukaryotic tree. These are what we used to call uniconts. We now have another name, which I refuse to use because I can't be bothered, because it will change in 5 years. And then the other half are the biconts, which is the other half, and there was nothing there. This was terra incognita. Okay, there was no clear lamins. Now, so, you know, what's going on? And to some extent, what's going on with the other amoebae, and what are fungi doing? Now, there's been a number of candidates for bits and bobs that might produce the lamina in other systems, and one of them that I'll highlight is, this is the work from Iris Meyer, that she identified proteins that she called NMCPs, nuclear matrix constituents. These look, to me, at least function, that have a cat's box. Sorry, this is the lamin, excuse me, they don't have a cat's box, excuse me. They are quite a bit bigger than the lamin, but they are coils and they have nuclear localization signals. The work that she's done in Arabidopsis, I think, is quite convincing that if you use siRNA, you get the kind of phenotypes that you would expect to see if you have a lamin defect. Okay, so this looks pretty convincing. There's no evidence for lamins. We went back and had a look harder using more sophisticated search algorithms to try to find the limits to NNCPs. Were these really just plants? Because Iris had looked at a number of different plants, or could we manage to extend this? Could we break outside of that set of taxa? The answer is no, we can't. Okay, we were able to find more examples, but we were not able to break outside of plant. Okay, so this is, as far as we can tell, is a plant-specific thing. About 5 or 6 years ago, we discovered a protein that we have called NUP1, which is what we believe is the lamin in, or lamina, in trypanosomes. And it's an enormous protein again. This is the lamin by comparison. It's a huge thing, whereas the trypanosome one is, as a Brucei is here, it's a massive thing. Highly coiled and repetitive, and etc. But again, looking really, really hard, using, you know, hammer and various other approaches, we were unable to break outside of the trypanosomatids. So this, again, at least as far as we can tell, is an independent beastie. So when we look for the lamins, we got a bit of a surprise. So we'd already found things. We knew things were in metazoa. We knew things were in Sarcomedae, but we found lamins in haptophytes, dinoflagellates, and a few other taxa. Okay. And then in blue here is the NMC, so it's not one, and then this is the NMCPs. Now this is funny to me. I mean, funny, not in an amusing way, it's just really weird. Because it's really patchy. And of course this worries us that maybe our search algorithms just aren't.
That's Peter.
Pardon?
The more marine metagenome data?
Was looked through, yes.
It did do that,
yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So, you know, it's at least as far as our abilities to do these things, you know, there's massive gaps, okay? Nicely, this is the gene tree, and this is the gene tree, and this is the taxa tree. You know, no lateral gene transfer. They match very nicely. We've not got any evidence for something like that. So we also suspect it means that we've identified the real thing. They really are lamins. So when we predict the domain architecture, you know, we can see that, you know, all of the various breaks in the coil are mapped to exactly the right place. And, you know, accepting that, you know, these algorithms are inaccurate, but if we accept that their inaccuracy in finding breaks is the same whatever sequence you give it, you know, it's finding the same kinds of changes in structure. They have these phosphorylation sites and CAX boxes. And a couple of them target to the nucleus and we get fibers. So this is a mammalian nucleus with a mycete lamin. Okay. So they, you know, they really, really are lamin. So to answer, you know, the question is that, you know, we kind of don't know what's going on, and this really, you know, tells us, you know, that we really do probably have three different systems, and we probably have more, but we just haven't found them yet. But it's likely that some of these other organisms have got things that can do what lamins do. We know, for example, in Saccharomyces that some of the proteins that are associated, or some of the nuclear envelope proteins appear capable of subtending heterochromatinization without having a true lamin. So it may be that, in fact, we don't need a lamin in many, many systems, that it's possible that you can just dispense with it. So, you know, so fungi, you know, we assume have lost it because Dicte and Metazoa have it. So I think that's probably where we are. On understanding the evolution of the lamins. I have more stuff, but I think you're probably running short of time.
Clarify a little bit. So you talked about the NMCPs.
Yes.
Those were mainly in plants?
Yes.
So, but plants have lamins as well?
No, they don't.
Oh, they don't?
Oh, no.
Okay, so you think he's substituted?
Yeah. So Iris has done a very nice job of using, I think, siRNAs and demonstrating you get the kinds of problems of misshapen nuclei, transcriptional control starts to loosen up, I can't remember if she saw nuclear pore mispositioning, but you know, sort of classic things. When we do the same experiment with NUT1 in trypanosomes, we get exactly that. We get lots of heterochromatinization, we get nuclear pore complex clustering, and nuclei explode and various other things.
Is there any sense where these came from?
No, this is the problem.
They just sort of...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so now we're left with a conundrum. You know, the probably the most parsimonious explanation is that the lamins were in Leica, because they're in enough taxa for us to suspect that. But, you know, are these just losses? And then if you did lose it, at some point you must have replaced it. So, yeah. So that is a problem for us, is to understand how you could have taken something that's 60 kilodaltons and replaced it with something at 450 kilodaltons and got away with it. And that I don't know.
Is there much known about splice variants in laminase C in evolution? You know, in humans, that's a big deal.
Yes.
In the Hudson-Gilford,
Rogeroy
syndrome.
Yes, and progeria, yes.
And we, as we get older, have some of that stuff.
Right,
I was wondering, in other organisms?
In other organisms, I don't know, and I certainly haven't come across anything that has looked at that. I mean, the point is, you know, we've only just found this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nobody's really worked on these things. Many of these organisms don't do much in the way of splicing. I mean, many of these don't have introns. I don't know.
It'd be interesting to look at the mammalian.
It's a very interesting question. But yeah, we have no cell biology really associated with any of these at the moment.
Given how poorly conserved cold coils usually are, I was wondering whether or not these other MMCPs may be just flying in the background there, and that maybe perhaps, for example, both of those, both lamins and those, were in the original organism and they just tossed out with
the earth. We don't think with the lamins. We found that the signal was remarkable. Mm-hmm. That when we used hammer, that we either saw it or the next hit was clearly not. It was a really very, very strong signal, despite the fact that the actual primary structure was really quite divergent. So that wasn't a problem. With NUT1 and MNCPs, absolutely, it was more of a fade-out. And so that when we got to the root of the basal plants, that the homology with the higher plants was very weak. And the same thing with NUT1. So absolutely, it may be that these are more extensive. We can't rule that out. For the lamins, don't think so. Because it really does look like it's a very, very strong drop-off, and so it doesn't look like there's anything close in there, or that we weren't seeing that kind of problem. So the structure, the secondary structural architecture, is really well retained. Whereas again, when we look at NUT1 and NNCPs, the arrangement of those coil cores moves around quite a bit.
So one possibility then is that both were present and that the organism just lost one or the other?
That's a possibility, is that we could have had, you know, or a transitional state where you know, something here, you know, had NUT1 and the lamin, and then it threw one of them out, or in the case of trypanosomes, it threw both of them out. So there does look to be this kind of riffing sort of thing going on. I really don't know.
I wonder if you could go back to the slide where you had the evolution of the nuclear envelope according to your view, and just talk us through the selective forces you think might have been operating during those transitions.
Sure.
Good question.
Very good question. Absolutely. So you mean this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we think that certainly the ability to cap membrane was part of the evolution of the ability to invaginate and essentially start doing membrane transport. So phagocytosis, other processes. So that becomes an advantage, is that you're becoming something that can move, an organism that can move things around and can differentiate compartments. Fenestrations is something that, so we know from ER structure that it forms sheets and that there are holes within there, and this is a very efficient way of organizing a large amount of membrane within a cell. So this is something that is potentially easy to understand.
It's
a sheet. So if you imagine a sheet, so the ER is double membrane. So this is the membrane. It's a sheet. But when you visualize it in 3D, it has very, very big holes in it. Okay, so fenestration is a window.
Is that membrane kappa, is that the cap on a sheet or is that the cap on a finger? I'm just very confused about the dimensions.
Could be either, because the dimensions are the same. If you look at ER, incredibly precise positioning between the two sheets. It varies very little.
And so the fenestrations, are they capped by COP2?
They could have been. I mean, you know, this beast may not have had COP2 at that point.
Yes,
they are. Yes, as you know, the ER exit sites, that absolutely is where you will get budding. And certainly the role of fenestrations is simply to provide more edge from which you can bud. You do not bud from the flat sheet. You only bud from the edge because it's this thing that can then start pinching membrane off. You don't pull it out from the membrane. Thermodynamically, that's much, much more favourable. So this provides a site to nucleate.
Yeah.
Well, it's to get more surface area or to get more bud sites. So, for example, or to get more bud sites, you know, bud sites for where you can actually take vesicles and to do your transport event. So in the Golgi complex, you see exactly the same kind of thing. You have cisternae positioned, and at the rims of each layer of the Golgi complex, the centre is almost like a contiguous plate, and on the outside you have these fenestrations, and that's where the vesicles tend to originate from. That's where you've got these potential membranes membrane bending things to allow you to bud off. Yeah. And you can certainly see that from the Golgi reconstructions that have been made.
Okay. So I was going to ask this to Shelley on Friday, but I can ask it to both of you. So why do we need to put a membrane around the nucleus in the first place? If you can get rid of it during mitosis, why is it important to have it for the rest of the cell cycle?
Well, most cells, I would argue, don't get rid of it in mitosis. I think closed mitosis is... We had this discussion and I sort of used the word more common and then realized that's probably a loaded term. But the vast, or many, many taxa have closed mitosis, so you don't need to do that.
Of the organisms that we know,
absolutely, absolutely.
Most of them have closed mitosis. And then I just said that we don't know the rest of them.
Yeah.
They still became permeable to... There was, you were talking about the permeability barrier and that goes away. So why do we need a barrier in the first place?
It's for interphase and for, I mean, the simple answer is differentiation of transcription and translation. It's a simple answer. The more complex answer is you can start to bring in RNA processing and differential splicing events, for example. An even more complex answer is to bring in things like heterochromatin, which really does seem to be fundamental to developmental control of gene expression.
I think there's a simpler reason, which is to put all the energy metabolism in one area and protect the DNA from all the oxidative...
Absolutely, yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, certainly, that's also an argument, absolutely. There are also arguments that the nuclear core... wherever it is down here, is in precise dimensions to not let an enormous number of viruses in, for example. You know, so that's been touted as a reason. Why is the nuclear pore the size it is? Well, if you made it bigger, your genome would be bombarded by viruses, so that's why it's the size it is. It may also, you know, have something to do with the architecture of the scaffold, but it's a just-so story.
So that's an argument.
Is there much energy metabolism going on when the nuclear envelope dissolves during open mitosis? During mitosis, is there a lot of energy happening?
There's an enormous amount of requirement for energy consumption, and I don't know if the mitochondria are thought to inactivate or anything. I've never seen anything that would suggest that. I mean, there's obviously been sort of suggestions of shutdown of things like some of the membrane trafficking events, but some of that data has been questioned. It was always thought, I think originally, that endocytosis stopped, but I've seen papers that have suggested that that's really not quite right. There's an enormous energy demand because you've got to build a spindle and an entire new genome, a whole bunch of new membranes, and drive the cytokinesis furrow through. So that's a pretty energetic. I mean, it's such a mess. You know, mammalian cells take an hour or so to get out of mitosis before they will actually move off. You know, there's always checkpoints that have to be met. A huge amount.
Okay.
So it's a, you know, it's, they don't just go boop.
Okay, so Mark's going to be around for, I guess, this week and most of next week?
Yes, I think I leave on Friday, actually, so next week. So
we'll be around for discussions. We may have some sort of a little of a special discussion.